You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's sports podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and with me in the studio, it's Neil Statman Payne. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad, how are you doing?
Doing well. Neil, you're about to go on vacation.
Thank God.
You
at
are?
Long last. Yeah.
To where are you going?
I think we talked about this when I was wearing my Toronto hat. We're going to go to Toronto.
Oh, you might. I was so focused on the blasphemy.
Yeah, you were
wearing
your scorn was so.
I didn't
so
hear the
great.
Story around
yeah.
the hat.
Uh-huh.
Nobody but Neil Statman Payne goes to Canada in February for
yeah.
2 weeks.
Hey, I got a week vacation.
Canada,
let's go to Toronto.
That other voice you hear, listeners, is Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist and our national statistical advisor. Kate, when did you talk to Russia, and what did you say when you did?
It was before the inauguration.
Okay.
But I didn't think it was a big deal.
Yeah. Who cares what version of war they use?
We're old friends.
Their Corsi is great. So.
Do you put extra effort into my second ESPNW columnist plus whatever my special one will be?
Doesn't roll off the top of my head, yeah.
I was just going to say I appreciate it because I think you understand how much enthusiasm I have for my second title.
It's about setting the tone of the show for you, Kate. This is all an alley-oop. That's what a good host does, you know?
I'm probably going to lay it in and not dunk it, though.
That's fine. Okay. That's fine. Two small announcements before we get going with the show today. You know what? Let me tell listeners what the show's about.
Mm-hmm.
Then we'll come back to the announcements. We're going to talk about the NBA trade deadline. It's coming up on February 23rd, just 9 days away. And
Short days, Chad. Can you feel it?
Going into All-Star Weekend, we figured there would be plenty of activity that we wouldn't necessarily be able to discuss if we waited a week to discuss it. Some of it happened today, even before we taped. So we'll talk about that with 538's Kyle Wagner later in the show. And then the Red Wings, the empire is collapsing.
Crumbling.
Folks. For 20-something years, the Red Wings were great. And now...
25.
25 years. And now, not so much. Neil Payne will tell us what happened. And then pitchers and catchers have reported. So it's time to talk about baseball. I'm very excited. We'll talk about the home run, the role of the home run in today's game, and whether or not it's weirdly less valuable, even though it's more present than ever.
This is week one of us not talking about the NFL.
That's mm-hmm. correct.
So
now,
we...
did you break that, though, by just mentioning it?
So I won!
Me. No, no.
So I won!
The bet was whether or not there would be a segment.
The over-under was 4 weeks. And I'm taking
you
the,
took
under.
The under. Correct.
You took the over.
Right.
Okay. It's week. Nobody's won yet. I'm just pointing out it's week one.
Certainly, it's the case that I'm in better shape than I was before this show started.
You are certainly probably statistically closer to winning.
All right. Well, stay tuned, listeners. And it's just you and me for the next couple of weeks here, Kate. So.
Why? Where's Statman going to Toronto?
Where there's no football.
Canadian football.
All right, so the small two announcements. One, we are doing our second ever and second annual live show. It will once again be the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. The Sloan Conference and that live show is coming up the first weekend of March. It'll be March 3rd, which is a Friday. As last year, listeners, we can sneak, and by sneak, I mean give you tickets, a couple of you, to get you into Sloan, which, you know, you may
it's a
have
big
interest.
Deal.
You may have interest in. Regardless, but in order to do that, we're gonna a little sweepstakes, and it's an entirely corrupt sweepstakes, one in which we're basically asking you to bribe us to give you these tickets in order to be someone who might be able to come to Sloan. We need you to leave an iTunes review and rating. Okay, let me tell you the last time that someone left a review and rating. Now, people listen to the show. It might be hard to believe, but people listen to the show, and yet. Our last iTunes review with a description, not necessarily just the five stars, but this is something fully written out. November 16th,
Ooh.
It's February 14th now. Happy Valentine's Day, guys.
Yeah, happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Aww. Hey, hey. November 16th, it was written by someone named Obese Cat.
Obese Cat might be listening to this.
Listen, folks, even if you don't want to come to our live show, you can do better. At least one up that screen name, regardless of what you write. I want to read Skinny Dinosaur's thoughts on Hot Takedown. I want to read Floppy Iguana's thoughts. I want to read Scratchy Emu's thoughts. But the point is, if you want to come to our Sloan show, or if you just want to give us some love on iTunes, please go leave a review and email podcast@538.com if you'd like to come to Sloan with a screenshot of your review. Doesn't matter how many stars. We just want, you know, some feedback.
But it could be that if you left us a bad review, we wouldn't want to give you the tickets.
Kate, you're not in charge of letting people in because of corrupt thoughts like that.
Do you think
this is a blind line.
I am the national security administrative advisor.
Neil, impugning the intentions of a whole country.
Well, you know, I wanted to say the obese cat would be a great nickname for a player. I feel like that was like Andre Scalaraga's slightly overweight brother or something.
I like that very much. All right, Andre Scalaraga, if you're listening, you too can come to Sloan. Just leave a
review. But only if you put on some weight.
Just leave a review. All right, should we move on to the show?
Sure.
Now we're done with that business at the top? Great. Let's talk about basketball. The NBA trade deadline is February 23rd. To me, the NBA trade deadline is always super fun because the NBA is a game in which complementary players can really have an effect on a team. Even a player who might play only 15 or 20 minutes, you have different lineup rotations that are then possible. And especially come the playoffs, the idea of sort of limiting and negating the other team's best player or certain lineup can be really important as you play them for seven games. So it's a time where teams really tinker on the margins, but those margins can have a real effect from where I sit at least. Neil, you may have differing opinions.
No, I think that's a fair assessment.
And so here to talk about the deadline, what might be happening going into it in the future, and what's already happened is 538's Kyle Wagner. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Chad.
Kyle, your Hot Takedown debut.
I think that's true, yeah.
It only took us a year, which
14
I apologize
months,
for.
Yes.
So, Kyle, we have you here to talk about the NBA because you're super smart about the way roster is constructed and the way sort of the teams have allocated the resources and things like that. I think let's start with three of the things that have already happened, and then maybe if we have time we can talk about what's to come. Let's start with Kyle Korver, who is now a Cleveland Cavalier in a trade that sort of sent the Hawks – Mike Dunleavy, Mo Williams, and a future first-round draft pick, which is protected and some cash. And the Cavs get Korver. Kyle, was this just a matter of, with J.R. Smith out, that the Cavs just need somebody to bomb the ball from three?
Right. I mean, James Jones was getting minutes for them in the finals last year. They were playing Richard Jefferson extended amounts of minutes. Part of it is that you can get older guys, for fewer assets than the young guys, but... But yeah, they're just loading up with, four shooters around LeBron and going to town.
So is Korver diminished from what he was when he was really good with the Hawks a couple years ago? Because when I saw this trade, I was, as someone who follows the NBA, but not as obsessively as some in the room, I was surprised that Korver could be had for a sort of protected draft pick and a couple players.
So his numbers had fallen off a little bit in the last season or season and a half in Atlanta. Some of that's because of the personnel changes that have happened down there. They really ran the offense to get him open shots. But since he got to Cleveland, he's shooting 50% from three again. And he takes something like 68, 69% of his shots from three. So he's doing pretty well.
Yeah, it is kind of weirdly illustrative of how much a player like Korver in particular is sort of like dependent on the talent around him to kind of get him those looks. And, he'll have a 70% true shooting percentage when he kind of is in the perfect system with Mike Budenholzer and has, all of the talent that Atlanta had when they won 60 games. And then, yeah, he kind of looks old and decrepit when that support system isn't around. And then it's amazing when you start playing with LeBron how much your true shooting percentage goes. goes back up. And that, I mean, his sort of like value hinges almost like exclusively on that number in that true shooting percentage column.
And by the way, like him looking old and decrepit was like shooting 39-40%
from 30. It was still ridiculous. Like, yeah, but he just like did so few other things, if you kind of reduce his shooting from otherworldly to just kind of like good, that it's kind of like flips him from being super valuable to not as valuable.
I know we have a couple other like smaller trades that have happened, but if you're looking at the NBA trading deadline and the NBA broad picture, you've got obviously the Warriors and then the Cavs, and the Cavs are in the market to continue to add pieces to fill out that roster so they can compete with the Warriors. Is there any other team, when you look at them, where you think they could actually do something before the trading deadline that actually matters? Not matters like, hey, maybe they're going to make it another playoff round, but like legitimately in the grand scope matters.
Well, the team that everyone's looking at is Boston, because, I mean, the question is if they're going to give up any of their young players, if they're willing to trade Marcus Smart, if they're willing to trade the Brooklyn Nets pick to get something back like Paul Millsap, who Atlanta still swears up and down they're not going to trade, but apparently no one believes them. But yeah, they're been linked to Melo, they've been linked to Millsap, they've been linked to Adrian Wojnarowski was talking about...
We just call him Woj.
Woj, yeah. He was talking about they're trying to get in on Jimmy Butler and Paul George, which seems ambitious, but yeah, they're I think the ones that could do something.
Is there any trade that Boston can make where they're adding enough value and not having to ship value out, where they legitimately, you could look at them in the Eastern Conference and say they could compete with the Cavs? Because it looks like you're going to get Melo. Are you giving up Smart? Are you giving up one of your younger guys that then compromises your overall ability to truly compete in the Eastern Conference?
Well, it depends on like what you think of the players. Like the Boston team, the Boston front office has a pretty high opinion of Marcus Smart and a lot of the players that they have there, Avery Bradley, that doesn't seem to be in sync with what a lot of the other teams think of those guys. But, I mean, they have that Brooklyn Nets pick just sitting in their pocket. So, obviously you would like to get, you know, a guy on a rookie salary if it's like Lonzo Ball and he's super, super good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, if they're willing to give up that pick, then they can just add without giving up too much.
It does seem like, though, to your question, Kate, that if you were to see a sort of championship-shifting trade, presumably would happen in the Eastern Conference more than the Western Conference, where the two top teams aren't going to trade anybody, presumably, and it's more of a an aristocracy there, versus in the East. Yeah. You could see with the Cavs injuries in particular, Kevin Love's now out for 6 weeks, there's the ability to perhaps upset the Cavs and then make a run in the finals and you get closer.
Although, as we've seen, I think each of the past, almost probably 6-7 years, we've talked about how these various LeBron-led teams, whether it's the Heat or the Cavs, that like, oh, they're Indiana, they just added a player, and you know, now it's the Celtics, if they just add a player, that they could beat them. But we've yet to see the LeBron team actually get defeated by an Eastern Conference team along the way. So I don't know if maybe they're just a team that always sort of looks on paper like, oh, you know, they can be had, and then a switch flips once they get into the playoffs.
So that's probably a good segue into the Raptors, who today, as we're recording this, the 14th, acquired Serge Ibaka from the Magic for Terrence Ross and a first-round pick in the draft this year in 2017. That will presumably be a late first-rounder. This is an extension of the trade, and Kyle, you can explain this better than me, for Victor Oladipo when Oladipo went to the Thunder last year and the Magic got Ibaka back. This seems like a sort of incredible game of cups, you know, where you hide the ball in a cup or carousel or something.
So basically the Magic turned Victor Oladipo, who was the former, I think, second pick in the draft, into Terrence Ross. But they also traded away the rights to Domantas Sabonis, who's turned into a pretty good front court player in Oklahoma City, and Ersan Ilyasova in the deal too. So they got back late first rounder. It's hard to really see what the Magic are doing with this.
So Zach Lowe tweeted that basically that Ibaka wasn't working out. He wasn't going to re-sign with the Magic, and so you get rid of him for anything you can, and the market was soft for his skills. So maybe that's an explanation.
Oh, no, that's totally what they were doing. It's just they seemed very confident that they could convince Serge to re-sign with them when it seemed like a much less certain, you know, outcome than they were.
So I want to talk about what this means for the Raptors, especially vis-a-vis the Cavaliers. What does Ibaka give them that they didn't have before, especially if they were to meet the Cavs in the playoffs?
Well, I think the Raptors are Certainly, they've not been playing very well recently, but we sort of saw earlier in the year that in their sort of idealized form, they are this incredible offensive team. For a good month and a half, they had actually a better offensive rating than the Golden State Warriors did, which was pretty outrageous. And so they're also one of the worst defensive teams in the league in terms of points allowed per 100 possessions. So imbalanced team, it's kind of the classic borrow from what you're good at and make a trade to kind of improve what you're bad at, in the sense that Terrence Ross was, according to things like Real Plus Minus, a pretty good offensive player, pretty poor defensive player. Now they've gotten back Serge Ibaka, who is not a very good offensive player, but is a better defensive player, even if he's not sort of this like elite defender that he kind of looked like he could become a few years ago. So I don't know if that on balance comes out in the wash, or if it's better to be a balanced team, or if Toronto just needed to change something because they have been in this sort of like tailspin since New Year's Day. But it kind of at least makes them a more balanced team overall.
Yeah. Kyle, when you look at the – let's just stick to the Eastern Conference here. Let's say Cleveland doesn't do much more over the next 10 days. When you look at those next three teams, and let's say the next three teams are Boston, the Wizards, and Toronto, what do you think needs to happen with one of those three teams, each of those three teams, to compete for the Eastern Conference championship?
I mean, the honest answer is the Cavs have to stay hurt. And
right. So even if unless they're adding some blockbuster piece before the trading deadline, if they're kind of nickel and diming here and there, adding small pieces, like I would say Ibaka at this point is a small piece for Toronto. If none of
at least a medium piece,
You would say medium.
Yeah. I think he kind of changes the fabric of them a little bit. So he's a different player than he was when the Thunder were making their run in 2012. But he's actually recovered a little bit this year. So his rebounding has gone down in the last few years. His total rebound rate. But that's masked by a few things. One, he's not picking up offensive rebounds, which is more of a strategic decision. So, like, he's just not crashing those boards. His defensive rebound rate was pretty bad last year, and that's, like, usually not a good sign for an aging big man. He's only 27, but, you know, things happen in a hurry. That's recovered back to basically the rates when he was a younger guy, too. But he's become kind of a more mature player in Orlando also. So he's always shot the long two pretty well. But he's a guy who just, like, there are always guys like Amari Stoudemire, guys who just, like, shoot that long two really well. And it's just, like, take one step back. You're right there. Shoot the three. And he's shooting, I think, 38.8% this year. So I have this written down somewhere. Last season, 34% of his shots were from 16 feet to the three-point line, so long twos. This season, that's 17%. And last season, he was taking 21% of his shots from three, and this season that's 30. So, like, he's become, like, kind of a Maury Ball player.
You know? Right, more efficient in his shot selection.
And he's, like, Patrick Patterson, who, you know, has been slumping a little bit and been in and out of the lineup for the Raptors. Like, you can just plug Ibaka in, and, you know, he's going to give you a supersized version of that.
Yeah, the other thing with, you know, speaking about these Eastern Conference teams, to bring it back to Korver's old team and the Hawks, I wonder how they must be feeling right now, seeing as how they kind of made the trade to get rid of Korver. And it made sense, you know, he's in the last year of his contract and this, that, and the other. But then I think they were planning to become worse and kind of enter maybe a cycle of not being as competitive. And they've almost, like, won since then in spite of that, and so now they find themselves sort of in this place where it's like, gosh, we could really use like a Kyle Korver or something like that right now, because they're right there in the mix too. They have the same record as Toronto, but nobody really, I think, takes them as seriously just because they don't seem to have the firepower. But in the East, like we've talked about, it's a weird situation where it does seem wide open, and then at the same time we've yet to see a LeBron team truly not buckle down once the stakes get raised in the playoffs.
Okay, real quick before the segment ends, let's talk about the Blazers, because I know that's a hobby horse of all three of you who surround me. The Blazers made a trade a couple days ago in which they traded Mason Plumlee. All the Plumlees were on the move this trading deadline season, which I love. Mason Plumlee has gone from the Blazers to the Nuggets, along with a second-round draft pick and some cash. In return, the Trailblazers get Yusuf Nurkic, center of the Nuggets, along with a first-round draft pick, which is top five protected. Kyle, you begged me to talk about this because you think that the Blazers have been foolhardy with their spending and that this is a symptom of that.
Right. Well, this is so Mason Plumlee is a demonstrably better player than Jusuf Nurkić. It's just he just is. He's a better passer. He's viable. Like, Nurkić is a perfectly good starting caliber NBA center. But they're being forced to downgrade because Plumlee's in the last year of his deal, and they have no way to pay him next year. They are on the hook for $18.5 million to Alan Crabb, $17 million next year for Evan Turner.
Kate's seething at even the mention of this, of these players and these dollar figures.
And McCollum's deal kicks in next year, too, where he's getting paid 20-some million also. So they just have no room to pay Plumlee, and they're forced to downgrade.
Okay, well, can you just jump into the Blazers' head here? Because it's indefensible, in my opinion, what they paid these guys. And this isn't a case of an inability to understand that the salary caps went up and guys are getting paid a lot. It seemed as if they signed players without actually having watched them over the previous years in the NBA. Even in a higher market, Evan Turner's not worth $17 million a year. So I'm struggling to understand. I don't know, Neil.
You covered Evan Turner, right, when he was on
with
the Sixers.
And
yeah.
He's lovely.
He wasn't
and
good
I
then.
Adore
he
Evan
wasn't good
Turner.
Then, and he's not good now.
And but there, he's not a level of player that is at that That's, is at
he's
that
not
dollar
a $17 million
figure
now.
In any. I mean, I guess at some point, if the salary cap continues to increase and your ninth player on the roster is making $17 million, then by all means, pay Evan Turner $17 million. But what? Let's be as charitable as possible with the Blazers with these signings. What was their game plan?
I'm not sure because so you can say that they fell in love with like a nice little run that they had, that they were playing above their heads, and now they're playing a little under, and maybe this will all wash out in the aggregate. Sure. But that is if they sign these guys to shorter-term deals. Everyone is locked up until 2020. These are not 1 or 2 year deals. These are like 4 or 5 year deals that they're just on the hook for forever. They're going to have to keep like trading down or like, trading away, you know, assets that they're going to have to pay that they can't afford because you can't trade that Evan Turner contract. You can't trade the Alan Crabb contract, not easily at least.
It's especially baffling. I don't know. I have this idea that Portland has always been shrewd because of the market it's in, that they've, I don't know if you'd say they've overperformed, but like they're generally speaking competitive, even in a market that's smaller. And just to see them just willy-nilly hand out contracts to me seemed anti what I usually had thought of Portland and its ability to like put together a roster over the last like decade or so. All of a sudden they're just like lost their minds.
Nope. Yep.
That's a good note to end on insanity. All right, Kyle Wagner, thanks for coming on. Listeners, you can read Kyle's work at 538.com. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks.
For the last 25 seasons, the Detroit Red Wings have made the playoffs, the Stanley Cup playoffs in the NHL. This year, that's probably going to come to an end. That streak is probably going to come to an end. According to HockeyReference.com, they have less than a 7% probability.
Oh, that's down to like 1% now.
Oh, really?
Chad.
It's gotten even worse since they first calculated that?
They had a bad weekend in many, pretty much every possible way. Their owner died and they lost every single game
they
played.
That's not funny.
Whew. Ouch, I know. I was laughing at it.
Bad weekend.
Yeah. I wasn't even making a joke. It was bad.
I know.
Bad weekend.
I felt bad. I felt like I personally cursed them.
So we should say that Neil Payne, Neil Statman Payne, wrote about the Red Wings playoff streak and its likelihood of coming to an end for 538 this last week. A piece called The Red Wings Empire is Crumbling. So, Neil, let's start with what made that empire an empire from the get-go, and then we'll get later to what's happened this year.
Well, so the biggest thing was their possession rate. And I think we've talked about this on the show before. There's this family of stats in hockey that try to measure how much you have the puck compared to your opponents, because that turns out to be like a really predictive way to figure out who the best teams are. Things like how often do you score as a percentage of your shots, or how good are your goalies at stopping shots. Those are kind of oddly random stats. Like, they do have meaning in a big enough sample, but in the small sample of even like a season, which we wouldn't think of as being a small sample, they can be really fluky. But the possession stats and things like Corsi and Fenwick, these are fun names that people have come up with these for these stats, are actually sort of digging down to what makes a team predictably good. And the Red Wings were always predictably good at Corsi. They led the league and or were in the top five at the very kind of baseline for about two decades straight. So, like, once they started their run in 1991 of making the playoffs through last year, they – I think we're no ranked didn't ever rank outside the top 10, and I'd be surprised if there were only like
most
a few years
top five, yeah.
Yeah, in which they were not in the top 5, and that sort of drove things. And we had a podcast in our series Ahead of Their Time where we talked about the influence of Russian hockey, just to bring it back to our Russian theme that is running through the show apparently, on the NHL, and about how they played, they kind of ushered in this this possession based game when the Soviet Union fell and Russian players were actually allowed to play in the NHL, and Detroit just gobbled up all of the best Russian players: Sergei Fedorov, Igor Larionov, Slava Kozlov, Vladimir Konstantinov. They formed the Russian Five, which was the first group of kind of five Russian players playing on the same unit on the ice together. And once they got those guys into place, they started dominating the possession stats, and they formed this dynasty, won, you know, a handful of Stanley Cups. And this year, their possession rate is not good. Last I checked, it was about 26th out of the 30 NHL teams. And with that sort of uncharacteristic drop, sort of the whole enterprise has sort of collapsed in on itself.
But now, how do you explain the continuity that they've had in playing this possession style of hockey? Because I think if you look across sports, when you see success across a period of time as dramatic as a quarter of a century, you always have an understanding of what the common thread is, whether it's like a single coach in Bill Belichick or Mike Krzyzewski or Gino Auriemma. And then you understand how it's being passed down. Like, this is our style of play and this is what works. I get that the introduction of like a Russian style of play jump started or launched the Detroit Red Wings. But how have they been able to pass through this obsession, not obsession, but this possession style play across 25 years?
That's a great question, because typically when teams figure out like almost like a magic bullet to play
everyone
figures it out and jumps on top of it. And I think one of their advantages was they sort of cornered the market on a lot of these guys early, and they also had a coach who was the winningest coach, if not the best coach of all time in the NHL, Scotty Bowman, for a lot of the early period of their run. And so I think it took a long while for teams to kind of catch on to and be able to replicate what they were doing. The analytics era of hockey is not that old. So, you know, if the Red Wings dynasty is last 25 years, the analytics era of people figuring out like, hey, this possession thing is pretty important, we should try to emulate that, is less than a decade old. It's probably like the last third of that Red Wings period have other teams sort of like latched onto it. And they've also been like super fortunate with drafts. So they started out with Steve Yzerman as kind of the cornerstone of the team in the 80s, and then they were able to acquire a lot of those Russian players that I mentioned. And then, you know, they benefited from the fact that they were one of the biggest market, highest payroll teams, up to the point where the NHL instituted a salary cap. And then at that point, they already had these players that they had drafted, particularly Pavel Datsyuk and Henrik Zetterberg, who were each sort of like generational future Hall of Fame talents. They were basically like drafting Manu Ginobili with the second to last pick in the NBA draft. It was like that kind of draft fortune that they had, and those players were able, along with Nick Lidstrom, who kind of like the defenseman who bridged the eras of that team, they were able to kind of carry things over into the next era for those guys' entire career. Datsyuk left the team this past summer, and I don't think it's any coincidence that they collapsed with him gone, because he was sort of this player that I think would not have been appreciated as much in an earlier era where people emphasized physicality and sort of like strength. But since he's a very small guy, fast guy, very, you know, skilled guy, but his possession numbers were just off the charts. And so he's a guy that sort of like became known as this great all-around player in an era that was properly equipped to appreciate him fully.
So let me ask then, is that just all that's happened to make this empire crumble? Just one player leading? That seems like, you know, far too easy. It has to have been more systemic, you know, many years coming kind of rot.
Yeah, I mean, it's no doubt that it's the product of a lot of roster sort of like miscues, injuries, things like that over the years. They really just haven't been able to get as much out of their young players as the next waves have done in the past. You know, they were always able to phase in sort of like, hey, who's the new superstar that we have drafted and is coming up? And some of that is like great player development, and some of it is just, you know, hitting the lottery, and it shows that in hockey, when you get these great talents, you can kind of, you know, use that and leverage that for years to come. And now their kind of current crop of players have not sort of picked up that torch. And the other thing is, the NHL and all of these sports leagues are very focused on sort of redistributing the balance of power over time. If you're as good as the Red Wings have been, you get really bad draft picks, and you can punch above your draft weight for so long and kind of sustain things to a certain point, but then eventually it just catches up to you if you're never, you know, drafting the top talent and your opponents are. Eventually you do make miscues and you do have injuries and your goalie misses half the season and his replacement is terrible, and then all of a sudden you have a year like this. And I think with Detroit, all of those factors have kind of come together this year.
So for Detroit, for like the last 26 years or so, how important has goalie play been? I would imagine if you're playing a possession style game, you won't necessarily need like a super dominant goalie because you're also possessing the puck a lot, but you'd also need a high level of competence as well. How did they manage the goalie? Was it like superstar, competent, or did they do it a different way?
Well, they had an interesting mix of goalies over the time than when they were in the playoffs. So when they won the Cup in 1998 and 1997, they predominantly had these guys that weren't necessarily statistical juggernauts. They had Mike Vernon, who was this guy that was really good in the 80s, playing the kind of stand-up style of goaltending that had been pretty much obsolete by the 90s, but he was still able to kind of hold on and have another, you know, one last great playoff performance. And then they had Chris Osgood after that, and he was, you know, a good but not certainly not a Hall of Fame caliber goalie by the stats. And then they went out and they signed Dominik Hasek, who is, I think by most accounts, the best goalie in the history of hockey, and they used him for a few years, and once he got long in the tooth, they've kind of gone through a variety of different goalies. So I think you'll see this with a lot of hockey teams where even the successful ones will have stretches where they'll have a great goalie on, you know, on pedigree, and then he'll have like a terrible year, and they'll have to kind of retool on the fly. And sometimes you get Jimmy Howard, who has been one of the best Red Wing goalies of that span, and sometimes you'll get Peter Mrazek, who's their goalie this year, who has been one of the worst in the league.
So I have maybe a broader question. It's about the Red Wings, but it's a broader question too, which is, across sports, if you have a team that has been dynastic in quality, so the Red Wings, I think, only won 4 Stanley Cups in that 25-year span that we're talking about, but still dynastic and being around every year. I think you could say the same thing about
it's about as good as you'll get in hockey.
Okay, so yeah. So you could say the same thing about the Spurs, for example, who maybe didn't win as many championships as you might expect, given how good they were for so long. But my question is, when you go from that consistently good team to a bad team over 1 year, is it easier for a team that has shown past dynastic success to come back from bad and return to good on a regular basis than it is for a team that maybe, you know, is a bit more scattershot? The idea being maybe there's some value baked into the ownership structure or to just the sort of general ebb and flow of talent within a league.
I think that's probably true. The Spurs are a pretty good example of that, because we have been speculating, or there was a period of time where we were all speculating, like, is this the end of the Spurs dynasty, when they were losing in the first round and kind of, you know, seemed, I think one of the years they didn't even like crack 50 wins or barely crack 50 wins. And it was like, okay, they've had their fun, you know, their time is over. And then, of course, like, Kawhi Leonard comes in and suddenly they're, you know, maybe like the second best team in the league the past couple of years, or third best at worst. And so, you know, maybe there is something, if you have a coach and ownership infrastructure, to encourage the kind of prolonging of this beyond what maybe logic would dictate you
right.
being able to do.
Well, it seems like there's examples on both sides of dynastic franchises bouncing back quickly versus dynastic franchises still floundering. And so I'm thinking of the Yankees. Like, they were great, and there's never a time when the Yankees so far have been down for a very long period of time. So I'm like, maybe there is something about, one case, having a lot of money, and also
before ownership. When Steinbrenner brought them, they were bad for a while. But yeah, go ahead.
But not
that
like,
was a rare moment in their history.
But then you look at the Dallas Cowboys, and I know I would have thought that they would have won another Super Bowl and have been better since the 90s. And so I don't. And then I'm trying to wonder in all the various examples if there actually might be value baked into a franchise if it reaches a level of dynastic success that would allow it to bounce back quicker, or if it's as random as any regular franchise trying to bounce back.
Yeah, and I wonder how, you know, first of all, I wonder how much of it varies by sport, because in a sport like baseball, where
you can
kind of leverage the fact that you're the Yankees and you have this ridiculously rich TV contract, you can turn that around and invest it in free agents, and there's no limit to sort of, or at least there's only like a soft limit to the amount that you can leverage that. That's a little different from, you know, a sport like the NFL, where being the Dallas Cowboys only gets you so far as having Troy Aikman and Emmitt Smith and Michael Irvin in their primes. In a lot of cases, the NFL teams that were great during the 90s when they put in the salary cap had a lot of problems adjusting to that because they had so much talent when that got put in that they couldn't continue the dynasty. So I guess it does vary by sport. And I think it just does come down to maybe it helps on the margin to be able to have like that infrastructure in place that sort of like creates, they always talk about the culture of winning, you know, which sometimes it seems like you can't have a culture of winning until you actually win something. Well, how are you supposed to win something? Oh, by creating a culture of winning. Yeah. It's like the circular argument. But maybe there's something to that. I think maybe more it's like just having good players. That's such a cop-out answer.
And what the structure is within a specific sport where your ability to get good players.
Right. Yeah.
Where like with hockey, I don't know the salary cap well enough, but I would think they would be
much more limited
than the Yankees' ability.
Let alone college basketball where recruiting, you know, or college football,
right,
where we're
recruiting.
Yeah, Kentucky is always going to be good for the most part.
So, okay, let's leave it there. Hopefully the Red Wings recover for anyone who likes to see, you know, proud franchises remain proud. And let's move from hockey to baseball. Pitchers and catchers have reported for baseball for folks like Neil and I, and I think for you, Kate, too, gets a little frisson of excitement whenever baseball season begins. Spring is on its way. The cold, dark days of winter are almost over, regardless of what groundhogs might tell us. To me, it's really about when pitchers and catchers report. So it's time
screw that groundhog.
That's right. So it's time to talk about baseball. I want to talk about home runs today. We were spurred by a piece from Neil Greenberg of the Washington Post, who often appears on this show to talk about hockey. He wrote about baseball this time, and he noted that in the last 50 years, there has never been a year that had more players who hit 20 or more home runs in a season than last year, when there was 111 players who did it. And he sort of connected a few dots to say basically that makes being able to hit a lot of home runs not as valuable as it maybe once was. And so you have players like Chris Carter from the Brewers signed for a measly $3.5 million one-year deal with the Yankees this offseason. Chris Carter has lots of other problems with his game. Mark Trumbo had 47 home runs last season and only signed for a three-year, $37.5 million deal for the Orioles coming into this season. And so I want to use this sort of to talk about baseball's home run binge and whether it's sustainable. And then also sort of what happens when a skill becomes overpopular. There are too many players who have that same skill in a sport like baseball and whether it's different in other sports. So we see there's still demand, for example, in the NBA for players who can shoot the three ball and defend well. And that is now what teams want to pay for, we've seen in some ways. But how do we know when there's a saturation point reached in sports?
Well, don't they – to some degree, baseball having so many more players hitting 20 or more home runs is a measure of versatility in players in a way that perhaps didn't exist 15, 20 years ago. And I would think – in basketball, there are more players that are shooting three-pointers and making them, and it's a level of versatility. But if someone's doing that, it doesn't seem like it's coming at the expense of something else. Where sometimes I assume in baseball when somebody's hitting like 40-plus home runs, it's coming at the expense of something else.
Well, strikeouts are on the rise in
or
the league
poor,
as well.
Poor fielding or whatever it used to be. They would be like, right. He's just a home run hitter. Whereas like now it seems like there's just a 20 home run guy or 25 home run guy. There's a level of like versatility and competence across the board with him.
And in basketball, maybe it's like sacrificing the traditional role of the big man so that you can have people who are kind of like floor spacers at positions that traditionally would be more anchored in the paint. I don't know if that's a bad thing, though, because like a lot of these things, it's tough to tell the difference between something that is kind of being overvalued in the market relative to what people have been willing to pay for it in the past, and also just things that are like good to have. For instance, after Moneyball came out, on base percentage was something that people decided was more valuable, and you could actually see there was a study done that showed the uptick in salaries for players that were good at it before and after Moneyball was published and discussed so much. And so, yeah, on base percentage became less valuable in the sense of you had to pay more in order to get it, and it wasn't a competitive advantage to kind of scoop up all of those guys. But at the same time, you would rather have a high on base percentage than not have a high on base percentage, and so it's something that sort of like you still need. It just costs more now. And so I thought of when I was reading about baseball and sort of like this sort of what skills are more valuable now. I thought about the skills that are less valuable too. For instance, being able to hit for contact and not strike out as much, and kind of being one of these little like, contact slap hitters.
Why do you think that's
less
valuable?
Well, I mean, I think first of all, people are seeking that out less, despite the Royals winning with players like that a few years ago, and people speculating that would lead to this massive, sort of like building project of teams trying to emulate that. In general, those types of players have kind of been phased out of the game and or just sort of like marginalized compared especially to the way the game was played in the 80s, where that was sort of your idealized picture of a player was Wade Boggs. It wasn't Barry Bonds. It wasn't, people that could hit home runs.
Well, but hold on. Isn't it also that pitching has just gotten better? Like, it seems like there are more 280 hitters now. Certainly that might be because they're striking out more and swinging for the fences more,
perhaps. I
think that's
true, yeah.
But it also, we've talked on the show before about bullpens getting much better. And it seems to me as though pitching has gotten better in the majors than offense has gotten, aside from this home run issue. But I don't have the numbers in front of me to back that up. And so couldn't it just be that the way the game is played, especially the expansion of the strike zone in the lower part of the strike zone, now doesn't favor hitters the way it did in the 80s?
Well, I don't know, because teams are scoring, especially with the uptick in the home run, which we can argue about how, first and foremost, how artificial that is. And there we've written some pieces over the past year about how maybe that's because of a juiced ball. Maybe, we don't know what's causing that. But that definitely spiked. And before that spike, run scoring was not very high. But now, if we can kind of assume that the way the game has been played the past couple of years is real and kind of the way that we can expect it to be played, at least this season and the next few, they're scoring as many or more runs as they have since the steroid era of the mid to late 90s. So I think it's the way. So I don't know if pitchers have gotten better at their job of preventing runs. They've just gone about it, and hitters have gone about it in a different way. And that's always fascinating.
So runs are on the rise. Are the percentage of runs in the league stemming from home runs in a greater proportion than they once were?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely true, at least if you're comparing to, before the spike in scoring happened, because the percentage increase in home runs per game doesn't conflict with my thesis,
which is that bullpen use, which is on the rise and is gaining better, has led to less of a batting average rather than those skills being selected against by baseball.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think it's probably a combination of the two. That's why it's like difficult to disentangle them, is because it's probably pitchers are getting better at striking guys out, and also major league teams are selecting for players that prioritize power over contact.
I am just mesmerized.
You're playing ping pong.
Yeah.
This is how I feel when you guys talk about the NBA.
Exactly. All I'm thinking is like the point was that there are fewer guys hitting tons of home runs, more guys hitting a good amount of home runs, and the amount of value that teams are willing to pay to a guy hitting a ton of home runs seems lower because they can get a lot of assets and a lot of home runs across a spectrum of players rather than just saying, oh, that's our home run guy. That's fair, right?
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
But the home run guys have more holes in their game than perhaps
that's
they want.
They're
okay, worse
so that,
players.
That was, yeah, that was like my
so
starting
like Chris
point
Carter
like,
strikes out all the time, doesn't do much right. besides hit home runs. And Trumbo and Carter, they don't field well. You know, it's not
but
something.
But it used to be that the guys who were designated hitters and just hit home runs or were like poor to mediocre first baseman who hit a ton of home runs, baseball just put up with them because they didn't have the metrics to say.
And I think Greenberg's – sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's –
which I just did.
I did mean to interrupt.
I think Greenberg's point is that – let's take the Mets, for example, because they're the always our baseball example.
Let's just Mets.
But so the Mets have this guy, Lucas Duda, who is injury-prone, but will give you 20 home runs – a year, one way or another.
He sure as hell can make the throw to home plate.
Right, which, you know, he's a better fielder than people make him out to be. But anyway, so Duda can hit 20 home runs. Can't necessarily play the whole season, at least based on the past few years. But the Mets stuck with him rather than sign Chris Carter because Chris Carter doesn't, even though Chris Carter hits more home runs, doesn't offer them more than Duda already does. And Duda was under contract and arbitration, blah, blah, blah. But the idea being that, like, if you can find 20 home runs more or less anywhere, then you don't need to spend for 40.
It's almost like it doesn't matter where the 20 home runs come from if they're concentrated in one guy or if they're spread
right.
out across everyone.
Right. If I'm going to hit 100 home runs a year, let's just say for...
As a team.
Why would I pay massive amount for two guys who hit 50 and strike out a lot if I can pay 12 guys who are spreading it out and they're good in the field and they can steal bases and et cetera, et cetera? Why weren't we doing this in baseball like 20 years ago?
But maybe we were. I mean, I think the one of the interesting things also about Greenberg's story is that he kind of breaks down the value according to wins above replacement of the players based on how many home runs they hit. So like 20 to 30 home run hitters WAR has stayed pretty constant at 3 WAR per player going back to 2006. But the value of the guys that have hit 40 or more home runs has varied. Right now, it was only 3.4, which is not that much more than your 20 home run hitter, which speaks to the point we were talking about earlier. But as recently as less than 10 years ago, say, you know, like 6 years ago, it was 7.5 WAR per player who hit 40 or more home runs. And that was actually maybe the exception, not the rule, because the curve also sort of like slopes down to where we are right now if you go back as far as 2006, 2007. The late steroid era. So I think maybe we just were spoiled by a generation of the home run hitters were also really good at other stuff. And like you've been saying, Kate, the book on the slugger from, you know, the history of baseball has always been that they do that and they also take away from your team in a lot of other different ways, but you tolerate it because they have all this power. And maybe, you know, we went through a brief spell where that wasn't true. We could have our cake and eat it too with these guys, and now we're back to having the guys be one-dimensional.
I think that's a good takeaway to end on. Kate, are you ready to talk about baseball without Neil for the next couple weeks?
No. I think we should talk about the NFL.
Well, you know, you'll have to put a word in with those who select topics for the show, yourself included.
Okay, good. I'll do that.
All right, let's leave it there. Let's move on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is delivered to us today, I deliver the significant digit. We talked before the show about whether to talk about UConn's record-setting streak, 100 wins in a row. As part of the sort of three main segments of the show, we feel like we talk about UConn women's basketball quite a bit, and nothing particularly has changed since we last talked about UConn women's basketball. But I do want to highlight one number, a significant digit even, and that number is 4, which is the number of times as many, so 4 times as many championships that the UConn Huskies have won since March 13th, 2013, as they have losses. They've lost once and won 4 championships since March 13th, 2013. That blew me away. Can you imagine?
You've won 4 national title games.
For every loss.
For every loss you've had.
That's
it
radical.
Puts it into perspective.
Yeah.
Very well.
So the Huskies beat South Carolina on Monday night, sort of narrowly. It was a tight game, and they were down at the half, and then in the last couple of minutes, still, I think, only up, was it 5? Or maybe in the last 5 minutes, they were up 2, 1 of 2, but pulled away to win. So they're at 100 games. There seems to be there's only one ranked opponent left on their schedule. Seems to be a sort of clear runway to the tournament, and then Maryland and Baylor and some others stand in their way there.
I have this. I have no backing for it, no analysis for it, but maybe it's just all part of the story of this year with UConn and before the season that they were vulnerable. Where I'll be interested to see 538's win probability for UConn heading into the tournament. My gut would tell me it should be significantly lower than last year with Brianna Stewart, but there's actually no rational basis to think that other than. Well, they don't have the kind of player
I think
who
it'll be,
would dominate that
I
way.
I think it'll be lower because of the preseason rankings, which we've talked about how that's baked in.
Right.
Because they weren't as strong, I believe, in the preseason rankings. But the, what's interesting is that the margin that they're beating teams by is actually pretty similar to streaks right. in the past. And so they beat their only remaining ranked opponent, which is the 22nd ranked University of South Florida. They've already beaten them this season 103-27.
Yeah,
sorry, excuse me, 102-37, I transposed to. That's
yeah.
it. It's
yeah, that
still,
was important.
Yeah, those extra 9 points.
Change
yeah.
everything. Points.
They matter.
It was closer than you thought.
Yeah.
The one thing there might not just be that UConn has gone backwards because they pretty much are the same, like you said, Chad, but maybe Baylor has gotten better. If you look at, we always drag out the Jeff Sagarin ratings because they're kind of the best women's college basketball. They're like the KenPom of women's college basketball ratings. Yeah, right now they have a rating of 112.4, which is in line with what they've had. But Baylor is at 109.6. And the difference between the two ratings is supposed to represent the theoretical point spread between two teams at a neutral site. That's shockingly close. Yeah. And it's really more because Baylor has gotten better than anyone else at number two has gotten in years past than UConn falling off.
I want you guys to know that every year I fall victim to choosing teams in the tournament based on interviews I've done, specific games I've watched.
I thought you were going to say Jeff Sagarin ratings.
Never. It's always done anecdotally by who I've spoken with. And so I'm going to pick Duke probably to make it to the final.
Because
ball.
Of Lexi Brown.
Yes.
Because like, it's such a delight to talk to her.
Even if their ratings are like, nah, well, Duke is more like
95.4, you know.
Yeah, I mean, they're good. I mean, mm-hmm. they have a chance. I will put them in the national title game.
Excellent.
Just because.
Love it. All right, let's leave it there and end the show. Neil Payne, a pleasure to talk to you. I'm sad we're not going to talk for 2 weeks.
I know. I'm sorry.
Are you
spending
sure?
2 weeks in Toronto?
No, not all of it in Toronto. We're going to have some staycation too. Going to see my in-laws, stuff like that.
And you're coming back not the next in two hot takedowns, but in three hot takedowns, right?
I suppose
just
so, yeah.
Just trying to drag you back as soon as possible. Kate Fagan. A pleasure to talk to you. Sorry I interrupted you so much today. I feel like I was on top of your words a little
you
bit.
You needed to interrupt me. It was about baseball, and your proficiency is much higher.
Not the only thing that's the case between the two of us. Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast cleanup hitter is Jody Avergan. Our intern is Kara Chin. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're also on iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, be sure to bring out your best animal-themed screen name.
We're looking at you, Obese Cat.
Leave a rating. Leave a review. Obese Cat, thank you for leaving a rating and review back on November 16th or whatever it was. Figure out a new screen name to leave one by. You might get a ticket to Sloan if you live in Boston or want to commute to Boston. I have no idea how many tickets we have, but leave those reviews, guys. I'm trying to scrounge up as many as we can. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.